Anyway, I thought I would introduce some new data, but really recap some of the main themes of this workshop. So as you know, this workshop has been about brain mapping and the mathematics that are used to understand random geometry. And you've seen many, many presentations about the cortex, deformation maps, interesting types of signals that are treated as random fields, and really some really novel approaches that are being used to look at. So looking at this from the standpoint of a neuroscientist, what tools are in high demand? What tools are being used? Well, I talked to Guillermo Sapiro once, and he said, well, isn't brain mapping just matching one differentiable manifold to another differentiable manifold? And that's what it's all about. And it kind of is. So there's three classes of tools. So as you've seen, there's challenges handling the 3D and 4D geometry of the cortex. So we saw, Jason presented some very elegant time-lapse movies. Then there's Michael's work and all of the sort of diffeomorphic metric mapping that work in 3D and 4D in the full volume. And these are being used primarily, a neuroscientist will see this as a way of mapping brain change, so either in childhood or in aging. But this isn't a particularly finished problem. There's many, many new deformation models. I'll talk a little bit about information theoretic matching for images that are being used for these problems. And it seems like this is a very active area of work. Another area that is really very new, and I'll talk about this a little bit, also has to do with signals that lie in Riemannian manifolds. So I'll tell you a little bit about what diffusion tensor images are. If you imagine at every point of a brain image you have a real symmetric positive definite matrix, and you want to start to do statistics and denoising and segmentation of these signals, obviously many of the Riemannian techniques that we've heard about are going to be applicable. And of course, you don't stop there. There's many, many signals coming up on the horizon, these high angular resolution diffusion signals, that are essentially, at every point, random functions with spherical parameterization. And we're only just beginning to think of methods. And again, information theory, I'll talk about how that can be used to analyze this type of data. So really, MRI has been the main focus of the workshop. It's been used by many, many neuroscientists to track growth in the brain, the progression of schizophrenia, dementia, looking at genetic effects on brain structure. And nearly all of the mathematical approaches are creating maps of what is happening in an image in a population and making an inference about it. There's a lot of interest in developing statistical maps to look at how drugs affect the changes, how genes affect the changes. So the first class of methods are all cortical. So we've talked about modeling the differential geometry of the cortex. This is being used in drug trials like Glaxo, genetic studies of how cortical folding is set up during development. And really very, very varied applications. How does drug abuse affect the cortex? And these are all looking at signals lying in this sort of essentially 2D manifold of the cortex. The other set, which we've heard about too, is based on the deformable mapping that takes one 3D image onto another, either to track growth during development, and you can see there's been high-impact papers in neuroscience that are using these techniques, or, a little bit more complex, trying to understand, in various neuropsychiatric diseases, what is the pattern of volume loss? So I think to a mathematician, these diffeomorphic mappings are essentially maps of volume when you transform an image onto its counterpart. There's an exceptionally detailed measure of signal loss and volume change that's taking place in the population. And thirdly, diffusion tensor imaging. So the third class of methods that actually there wasn't a lot about at this workshop, but it is certainly interesting. They essentially, rather than making tensors out of the data, you can certainly take MRI, flow it, and look at spatial derivatives of transformation and call these deformation tensors. Mm-hmm. This is essentially a technique that applies gradients to the brain in up to 200, 300 different directions. And if there's diffusion that is aligned with that direction in which the gradient is applied, the signal decays exponentially with a time constant that is a reflection of the diffusion in that direction. So you can imagine if diffusion is spherical and there's no structure getting in the way, that would be a little isotropic spherical tensor. If there's an axon or one of these fibers, these new nerve fibers that's here, that tends to cause water diffusion to be preferentially aligned. And so even though these signals are collecting information purely on water diffusion, they're being analyzed to look at the principal eigenvector fields, fitting geodesics through the eigenvector fields, and essentially looking at the manifold geometry, not just of the geodesics, but of the very high dimensional signals that you can collect at every point. Now, one area of interest is looking at whether you can map diseases as they spread. Now, most of us who are not ill, this is sort of something that is not something that we think about too much. A lot of the pharmaceutical companies are interested in metrics of change and metrics of factors that affect them. So there's interest in whether a drug is slowing tissue loss, which I'll show you. And many of these methods are using partial differential equations to warp data across subjects to get rid of this shape variance that's getting in the way of looking at systematic effects, or across time to look at essentially local measures and metrics of change. So the first class of approaches, you've seen various elements of this emphasized in different talks. This is sort of a car wash for brain images. So imagine that you have hundreds of these things, MRI scans in 3D. We've really thought about tools using mathematics to segment this data into graphs of elements, into different structures. Basically, the random geometry can either be helpful or it can be a nuisance. So when you flatten out these signals, all of the features that lie in these parameterized manifolds, they may not be consistent across subjects, so there's a lot of deformation approaches used to encode what the variation is or discount it. And very often there's metrics either looking at the local gradients of the mapping or signals after discounting the mapping to try and understand what the effects of genetics or a particular symptom or a medication is. So I'll talk about this first class first of all. It's a very interesting area. So suppose in a population you measured gray matter thickness. And Jason talked about this at length, so I won't go into too much detail. These images are not averageable. So we've seen so many instances where these binary maps, you just would not average these things together. So a great deal of work at UCLA and elsewhere is going on to producing smooth bijections, these invertible diffeomorphic maps that take this manifold on which the gray matter signals are defined, and really characterizing conditions which optimize power, which optimize axiomatic properties such as smoothness, conformality, area preservation. This is work by Anand Joshi at USC working with us looking at p-harmonic mappings, basically bijecting into a disk and using essentially well-known theories from differential geometry to show that these high-order harmonic mappings don't fold. Other ways, you heard Xingtun Yao talk on Wednesday about using holomorphic one-forms. These are conformal bases. They're essentially spectra which can parameterize flows within a surface, bijections of a surface to itself. I think the sort of influx of mathematicians familiar with exterior calculus, differential forms, and all of these notions of integrating with respect to a form, I mean, we've seen this notion many, many times, are being used to great effect. We've also seen 3D heat equations. So here's one to measure thickness. We can argue about how thick the cortex is. This one is very thick because the lines don't go in a straight line. But assuming the measure is okay, this can be done in a population. So again, validation is very important, but many of these PDEs segment a binary map, convert this into multi-valued signals on a manifold, get the thickness of the cortex, and then use this parametric grid as a uniform reference across subjects to integrate data. And basically these signals are the substrate for later analysis. And then to convert these things from subject, per-subject observations to statistics, you would have an idea of what the factors that affect the distribution might be, fit them, and then have fields of statistics, which Keith and Jonathan have pioneered, looking at the cluster size, the distribution, and the excursion sets of these statistical maps. And many of the applications are, where do these changes correlate with cognition, with symptoms, with IQ, or with medication? Now, what happens to you across the lifespan? Well, if you look at gray matter thickness, something terrible happens in the time that you're in graduate school, and then it kind of flattens out. And these statistical databases are essentially normative references for disease. And so if you imagine a time-lapse trajectory per point on the cortex after all of these normalization transforms have been applied, you could begin to develop random fields for departure from normal. And these are really the databases that are being collected. This is the cortical thickness from age 8, there's no subject younger than 8 here, to age 87. And you'll see that it really is a complex multi-valued problem. And people have often said, well, can't you do dimension reduction? Well, you probably can, but just see how different all of the trajectories are throughout the cortex. And so, obviously, there's a certain amount of high dimensionality to the data that needs to be examined. Does any of the brain mapping agree with what neuroscientists really believe and have known for many years? Well, it certainly does. So this is a classical map of beta amyloid. This is the molecule that gives you Alzheimer's disease. It accumulates in a stereotypical pattern. This is a map of cortical thickness, which has been averaged across many, many subjects with Alzheimer's disease, and subtracted to tell you to what degree people with Alzheimer's have a deficit in cortical thickness relative to normals. And I think, you know, there's a lot of interest in comparing pathology to images, but the congruence is very, very good. Now people have said, well, why are you measuring the thickness of the cortex when you're looking at the function of the brain? And so there's also really tremendous, I'll show you this timing. Everyone from LA has a movie, so I'll show you this in a movie. This is the time-lapse sequence. Sarang showed some beautiful movies earlier of aging. This is the time-lapse sequence of cortical thinning that's occurring in Alzheimer's disease. Jason's showing a lot of interesting data as well in aging and Alzheimer's disease. Notice how stereotypical these patterns are. So the white colors are regions with statistical deviation from normal in a cohort of Alzheimer's patients scanned every 3 months for 4 years. And in 7 seconds, we're seeing 4 years of the disease progressing. Now, I wanted to add a caveat about structural MRI. We love structural MRI, but 90% of brain matter has used functional imaging. And whenever we've shown our Alzheimer's maps, people in the PET imaging community, where they label molecules in the cortex, have said, can't we label amyloid? Can't we label amyloid as it spreads in the brain? And Michael Phelps and some of the people that invented PET at UCLA, they were at WashU at the time, invented a compound that can label the rogue molecule in Alzheimer's. But again, you can't get away from computational anatomy. These signal domains, these parametric models, they can help tell you essentially why these PET ligands, here it's a measure of how much amyloid there is in your brain. What is the sequence of accumulation? And even if you don't have a time axis to parameterize the evolution, you can begin to see models of amyloid accumulating. This is in people who are normal, who have high IQ, normal people with average IQ, normal people with low IQ, and people who are impaired. And something that's remarkable and I think disturbing is that many people who are normal have a huge accumulation of amyloid, certainly super normal. And this is where some of these surface-based methods are beginning to be used in the drug trials. So let's get back to the mathematics. I showed lots of population images. If you are this patient, are you normal? Well, unfortunately, I mean, the standard way to compare these images, most of the people in this room don't do this, but most of the people in the community do, is to sort of walk with a low dimensional transformation, this gray matter signature, or the PET signals, or the fMRI signals, onto an average of controls. Now, you know, we can maybe do a little better than that. So let's flatten these signals. We heard during the workshop, there are two main classes of methods to compare cortical surfaces. So if you like grids, if you're Xingtong Yao or the parametric surface people, you'll impose a spherical parameterization or a grid on all of your surfaces, enforce point matching and curve matching with a flow in the spherical parameter space. You may want to be very careful that you make your solutions invariant to the chosen parameterization. So we've heard about using the surface metrics, Laplace Beltrami, we're using covariant PDEs. The people here who are doing this, the sort of a faction of people who like parametric differential manifolds. Another way, which is completely philosophically different, is to use level sets. And I don't need to explain at UCLA who the people are who've been involved with this. But even the computation of these registration mappings proceeds very differently depending on whether you're using differentiable grid structures or level sets, and I'll tell you what I mean. So if you're a grid person, you compute a smooth bijection of a grid to the cortex, and if this is 0 to pi and this is 0 to 2 pi, any of your signals lie in that space. How do you match this surface with this surface? Well, we heard a lot of talks about that. So let's say you would like a bijection between this brain and this brain. Surfaces have to go to surfaces, it has to be smooth, C1, invertible. All of these curved landmarks have to match exactly their counterparts in the other brain. While Sarang talked about this problem at great length, one way to solve it and compute a vector that takes one surface to the other, matching landmarks exactly, is to use covariant PDEs. So if you're a grid person, you say, well, I can't do flows on the sphere. I mean, the sphere is parameterized in the cortex, but each surface has a metric. And so, a lot of interest, this was work initially done by Michael Miller and Ruge Makiasioglu in 1999, where they would biject surfaces onto spheres, recover many, many landmarks, and these are obviously functional landmarks we've heard a lot about, and essentially find a flow either in spherical harmonics, as Wu Sheng is doing, or non-parametric, you could find U of R in radial coordinates, that essentially optimizes some measure of smoothness. This is the covariant Cauchy-Navier operator, It's basically Laplacian plus something that controls the Jacobian or the divergence of the mapping. And essentially you get some nice flows that will smoothly map the parameter space from one subject to another. And if you think of the induced mapping between the corresponding surfaces in 3D, you can get a very, very nice smooth mapping. Not only does it satisfy some regularization condition, but it's also invariant to the gridding. A nice thing about this is when you use these covariant operators, they're essentially, as many of you know, derivatives in which this correction is made for gradients of the base vectors on the surfaces. You will get a grid invariant or gridding invariant solution to the matching. And this is very nice. So what people did before gave you smooth brains. What people do now give you averages from a population that have functions. Now, that's not really good enough, because any functional into a surface that has, it's fine if you have a surface that has positive or zero curvature, but if there's negative curvature, you can get singularities. It's sort of a problem with the mapping. So a lot of interest in these parameter spaces, given that you can use the Neale-Sampson theorem, basically, any harmonic mapping into a convex domain, flat domain, is a smooth bijection. You can map things into spheres or disks, and then use flows which Michael has proven are diffeomorphic in those parameter spaces to try and parameterize these mappings and keep them smooth. So this is work by initially Michael's group, and also Natasha Lepore and Alex Liao in our group, essentially optimizing these LV norms, matching curves in one subject with curves in another subject, and then recovering the mapping between brains in 2D and then maybe extending them to 3D to compute smooth flows. Where do the level sets come in? Well, everything so far has been parametric curves, parametric surfaces. Alex Liao, working with Stan in our group, had said, well, why are these curves always unit speed parametric curves? I mean, why do we say that a point halfway along this curve matches a point halfway along this curve in another brain? So one of the nice formulations for image matching that has exploited level set approaches uses the same regularization term. You still want these in the LV norm that Michael has developed to be smooth diffeomorphisms. On the other hand, though, you may want to constrain the matching so that all of this line matches all of this line, but without any sort of condition on where the individual points go, except that it has to be a monotone increasing mapping with respect to the parameter t. So this has been very effective. We've actually used this, and it removes a tremendous amount of the variance in the data. I mean, a lot of the variance, I think, was artifactual because we were nailing points to their associated parameter locations. And then the deluxe approach is everything's level set. So I think basically, work by Sapiro with Memoli and Stan here, and also Yonggang Shi, who's here, they've basically recast the surface matching problem in terms of implicit functions. They're very, very elegant work. It'd be interesting to look at their papers. They basically say, well, a surface is an isosurface of a higher dimensional function. If we'd like to compute here is a harmonic mapping, but you could put any function you like in here. Essentially, you can create an Euler Lagrange. The terms in the Euler Lagrange aren't those horrible Christoffel symbols and gradients of triangle lengths and things like that. You end up with some very, very nice curvature terms that can be computed with 3D filters. And Yonggang Shi, who's a postdoc at Loney working with Stan, has got a really, really nice numerical scheme to compute these mappings. And I think you can see that the mathematics is getting simpler. Maybe it doesn't look all that nice, but I mean, the number of operations is very, very much less. But really computing mappings with all the properties
that
we would
like.
That
looks so much simpler to me.
Okay.
Thank you for sharing it.
Well, the energy is, I don't know, because it's just got metric tensors and Frobenius. So, what can you use it for? Well, Judy Rappaport and her colleagues at NIH, Jason, I know, works with this group, scan kids every 2 years. And since they've been doing it since 1992, they have some nice time-lapse movies. Something that's interesting is there is this sort of stereotypical wave of gray matter thinning. We could look at other signals too. But I think, as Sarang said this morning, if you want to make a time-lapse trajectory from many, many subjects, this anchoring of landmarks that we've been belaboring so much is absolutely vital. And I think, the next generation of approaches would be like Jeff's approaches matching graphs. Essentially, you need a parametric, or maybe not parametric, but consistent domain to plot your observations. Other areas of neuroscience that have benefited from surface-based mapping, 40% of the criminals in Los Angeles have been using methamphetamine. if you do that for 10 years, your brain looks like this. This isn't a lot of loss. I mean, I don't want to promote the use of this drug, but it's only about 5% loss. But these are signals that the conventional averaging does not detect. And so the reason I'm showing you this is, if you average brain matter maps, which is something that neuroscientists do very frequently, this drug doesn't appear to have an effect on the brain, but with surface space alignment, you get rid of so much variance that you can detect it. Are there any surprises? Well, there's a few of them. So no one would predict that an infectious illness such as HIV, any infectious disease you expect to attack all of your body and brain, would be so selective. So these are actually now being used as markers in drug trials. There's an antiretroviral therapy that's quite good for HIV, and this is a marker that's being used. The thickness of the cortex yet again, but with a very stereotypical distribution of how the virus attacks the brain. Can geneticists use this? Well, yes, it's a sort of interesting thing. Now, population statistics and averages are very, very common in brain mapping. Genetics looks at the residual variance. It says, well, after averaging, how do we depart from the mean and do genetics explain this? Now, if you look at genes and brain structure in a population, you're underpowered. The best way to do it is to collect data from twins. Their genomes are identical in the case of identical twins. And you ask the question, can we get rid of the variance, not using diffeomorphic mathematics, well, you could use that as well, but some of it by controlling the genome. And so if this is cortical thickness again. If you have an identical twin, you're only 30% as different from them in cortical thickness as you would be from a randomly picked other person of the same age. Now, the reason I'm showing you this is that geneticists have been comparing correlations or variances between identical and fraternal twins and various sibships and kinship relationships. And you can begin to do genetics on manifolds. And so something called heritability. So this is the degree to which a variance in a trait is explainable by genetic variants. You can start to think of random fields of genetic parameters. So this heritability coefficient is the difference of two correlations, correlation in a trait in identical twins and the correlation in brothers and sisters. As you see, the thickness of the cortex, just an example measure, is almost identical in identical twins. So that means if you're interested in disease.
Can you just point it out, just show me, just for that point, just point it out.
Here's a point. So let's say I measure that in you and you have a twin.
Yeah.
And let's say your thickness is 4 millimeters. I can be 100% certain, well no, 95% certain, that your twin's thickness lies between 3.5 and 4.5, with appropriate numbers for this correlation. And the surprise is how heritable this is. And so if you think of population studies, the reason you'll hear a lot of these genetic designs being more popular is that if you have a trait that is highly genetic, you may as well not measure it in a population, you may as well measure it in twins. Now, it's sort of boring to say genetics affect you, I mean, which genes is it? So here's another class of methods. So let's say you have random fields in a manifold, and let's say you have the DNA from the people who you scanned. There are things called polymorphisms. These are individual loci in DNA that vary among each of us, but many subclasses of the population have a consistent genetic code at that location. One thing that people are doing very interesting is they're taking areas in which genes differ. So you can look at siblings. Most of their genes are the same, but these polymorphisms are different. And you can regress the amount of difference versus the amount of difference in brain structure at every point on the cortex to reveal a pattern where that gene may influence the cortex. Now, the problem is very, very low power. And so one of the nice things about this is that all of the diffeomorphic mapping, all of the manifold methods, are really showing these signals with much greater power than many of the conventional approaches. And I think this is an area for the future that will be interesting. Do we know anything about what determines brain structure? How about particular genes? Well, it's interesting. So a sixth of us in this room have this gene. And this means that we're 3 times more likely to develop Alzheimer's. You can be tested for it if you want. And there's no solution if you find the bad news. And I think that's devastating. When in an audience of 60 people, 10 of us have this gene. And so it begins to become very personal whether we can deter the deterioration that results. And these are not subtle changes. I mean, these are people carrying the risk gene that a sixth of us have. It's called APOE4. These people carry 2 copies, it's very rare. These people carry 1 copy. These people don't carry it. And it's visible, a lot of differences. What are good metrics? Well, here's one that puzzled people for a long time. So there's a genetic disorder called Williams syndrome. There's no place on the cortex that has an extremely different thickness, or anything you really measure, it's very difficult. But there are these global descriptors, and Mubusheng talked about this in particular. If you look at spherical harmonic representations of the cortex, if you look at the area of a surface at different scales, if you look at how that area increases with scale, this has been known to differential geometers forever, you'll get a measure of the complexity of the folding in the cortex. These measures, and few others, are very predictive of local differences in these diseases. So I think, often we're very misled in brain mapping that there's a location for an effect. I mean, there may be, effects across scale. They may be distributed and changed with scale rather than being at any particular point. This showing in children with Williams syndrome, I mean, the data looks terrible and very overlapping, but it is at least significant what that difference
so,
is.
So, Paul, you're making the point that here are effects that are linked to scale while not necessarily...
While not being localizable. Yeah. They may be localizable, but that wouldn't be the best initial way to do it. So, all right, there's going to be some more mathematics now. So everything so far focuses on the cortex. What about 3D? Well, we don't want to just look at the cortex. So let's consider deformal registration. You've heard many, many talks innovating in that area. Well, I just want to sort of remind all of us how little change there is. So this is someone with, well, they're normal. This is someone who's normal who was scanned a year apart. I know they've been, just rigidly overlaid. I mean, it actually shows that MRI scanning is good, and at least you get the same answer, but you're not really working with a great deal of signal. So a lot of these diffeomorphic flows that you hear Michael and his group and many others working with are trying to recover signals that are very small. And one active question is, what is the best deformation prior? What is the best model for these deformations? So let's look at it. So this is someone who is not normal. It's someone with Alzheimer's. And this is 4 years of repeated MRI scans. And you can see this sort of devastating expansion of the fluid fill space in the brain. But Alzheimer's is a cortical disease. What's the matter with the scans? They're not really detecting much thinning in the cortex. And the reason I'm showing you this is just how subtle the changes are. I mean, the ventricles are changing a lot, but the area that's responsible for the changes in behavior is the cortex, very, very tiny. So one of the approaches that's been proven better for serial change, I mean, looking at the thickness in the cortex, very noisy measure. And if you measure it again later, it'll be, confidence limits are very large. So let's look at the deformation maps. Here we're looking at the Jacobian of a transformation that deforms an earlier scan from a child of age 3 onto their later scan when they were age 6. So this is 3 years of growth. And, all we're plotting here is the mapping and basically the strain tensors and the Jacobian in color to see where the growth is. Well, this is nice. I mean, we've turned scans into tensors. I mean, basically, these growth tensors can be aligned across subjects using registration. And, this is the white matter growth. This is work by Shui Hua in our lab. She was looking at these mappings in children. And, the growth rates, I mean, it's kind of interesting. This is the corpus callosum. This is a region with rapid growth. These are fibers that come out of the corpus callosum, and they're innervating areas with rapid growth. And there's sort of new types of signals. But you can ask the question, what's the best approach to find them? I mean, we have a lot of approaches. I mean, a lot of people have been developing these. One general class is to find deformation vector fields that deform one image onto another, match features under some metric, and preserve topology with perhaps the LV norm that Michael has proposed. But look at how complicated the mappings are. I mean, they're sort of, as we've seen, they're curvilinear. And the target image may differ in signal substantially from the initial image. So one area that we've been looking at in detail is information theory as a measure of registration between images. So I know, obviously, for those of you who do this, this is silly, but when you register one image to another using a flow, you mathematically define a measure of similarity between the two images, or you can use whatever you like, and then you tune the 3D deformation field or the fluid flow until the images match as well as they can under that metric. Now, we've seen three approaches, and so if you're familiar with continuum mechanics, you basically use Cauchy-Navier or Navier-Stokes, you linearize it. Michael's models using LV norms, they're essentially variational presentations of the same energies. If you're a kernel regression person or a computer vision person, you say, well, actually, these are basically Green's kernels. So these flows are parameterized by linear combinations of Green's functions. So you could actually estimate flows with neural nets, or any other linear combination of positive functions. The final approach is really to worry about the data time a lot more. So we're a little concerned about L2 being used for image matching. I'll just very briefly, let's say in this invisible image here, there's actually two images that are misaligned. Let's say you want a metric that will align them. One that's good is mutual information. And so basically, at every point that you're causing to coincide by the transformation, there's an intensity in one image, an intensity in the other image. And the joint histogram, or the joint probability density, can be computed. And the overall mutual information, what one image tells you about the other, can be evaluated. Well, let's consider a basic model where you use gradient of mutual information to drive the flow. This is okay, the standard stuff. So, velocity field formulation, nice smooth flows. This is what's called the greedy formulation, where it's not integral and you iterate in time and estimate parameters in time. You're causing a flow to increase the mutual information between one image and the other, and you're using the gradient of this nice functional of image correspondence to drive it. Well, it's nice. You don't need mutual information to match binary images, but it does work. And it works in 3D for brains. This is actually work by Ming Chang Shang. Is he here? Yeah, there's Ming Chang. The next 10 slides are from him. And I mean, it's really very nice. I mean, these are different people. And when you deform this person to match this person, you get this. And they really are very similar indeed. This image does look very similar to this. But one of the things that, and you can track the Jacobian as well, but this is kind of the model to beat. So I don't know if you're very, thinking about, could this be improved? Mutual information is just a special case of a very broad class of divergence measures. Those of you familiar with information theory, you measure the agreement between two probability density functions using a divergence. This is just one. So others may be better for brains or for different signals. So Ming Chang is very interested in, there's this broad class of divergences between signal distributions called the Jensen-Rennie divergence. It's actually even more than this. But this is a parameterized measure of discrepancy between a histogram and the uniform histogram. And this alpha power is nice. You can play with that. The case of alpha equals one, it's the mutual information. And I mean, there's no reason to do this. It's just another metric that we just see how it performs on the images. And one of the remarkable things is it does really well. I do want to say a word about neuroimplementation. So what we're doing is we're trying to optimize the Jensen-Rennie divergence, which is a type of information theoretic measure of correspondence between two images. And we're trying to drive a fluid that will cause the first image to flow onto the other in such a way where the body force is the gradient or the Gatow differential of this formula here. Well, this is discrete. I mean, you've got to approximate the joint probability density function with kernels. It's very, very standard. But let's say you have a joint histogram. Think of a 2D grid where it's the co-occurrence matrix of one image intensity versus the other. You can have these little pars and kernels to have nice differentiable quadratic forms. One of the nice things is, I mean, it all becomes discrete again, even though you're using other functions. And you can pursue a reduction in this Rennie entropy, or entropy divergence, to push an image around. The force field to push the flow is essentially a convolution filter and some very nice, simple first-order derivatives of the image. And something nice about this, I mean, the reason I'm making a meal of it is it seems to outperform mutual information sometimes. That's sort of a heresy in the field of image registration. And one way that it seems to is, and you could say we've stacked the deck. Mutual information is a special case of Jensen-Rennie divergence with alpha equals one. So you know that if you broaden the class of functionals, it's a tautology that you can do better. The question is, does it generally do better? One of the things it does better with is capture range. And I think this is partly because the alphas are weightings on these. I mean, you can think of the norm equivalent to these. If you register some images that are very dissimilar, I mean, simple images, both methods do just fine. I mean, they register them okay, but the capture range or the degree of spatial misalignment that can be recovered is better with these functionals. And I think Ming Chang's tried very hard in his work to look at different metrics. And this, for example, is a standard one of just point landmarks. I mean, how well do they match up before and after transformation? So this is kind of the model to beat mutual information. It's the Jensen-Rennie divergence with the alpha factor set to one. There are others that are a lot better. This is the sort of measure of accuracy here. I'm sorry, the best ones are the ones with the lowest values. This is JRD with alpha set to 0.95. Now, you know, a complaint about this is you've got to run it again on more data, show me that it's consistent. But this kind of is a nice mathematical approach looking into the data term in a little bit more detail. Okay, so let's assume we know how to register images. How do we do statistics on deformations? Well, you can either use the Gibbs prior, I mean, you use the energy as a measure of the deviation, or you can differentiate the mapping and try and detect factors that influence the growth rate. So let's say you do this. Michael asked me what tensor-based morphometry is. This is another of Ming Chang's studies. Let's say you take a target brain, it might be one of Sarang's minimal deformation targets, and lots of people. And you know, some of them are ill and some of them are normal. You want to know where the differences in the volume are. You could use the Jacobian of these mappings as a local index of volume and then do scalar statistics. And you know, I mean, it's reasonable. So what I mean by that is, you know, if you have to squash the brain to half the size to match a point in the target, then it has half the volume and you can do statistics on the number of half versus whatever it is in the other subject. And this is nice. I mean, so Ming Chang was looking at HIV. I told you that HIV damaged the cortex. It does a hell of a lot of damage to the white matter. And if you only were looking at the cortex, you'd miss all of this terrible mess that's happening. I mean, this is a volume reduction in the white matter that's immediately below the cortex that we thought was the main sign of damage. Now, these fields, these Jacobian maps, the sort of rates of growth, this is an area that's been very actively pursued. I mean, work by Wu Cheng with Keith Worsley are looking at rates of growth. But I want to make one point with this. I mean, you can compare this across different populations. I mean, we all know that. I'll just go through some of these examples. There's a very rich amount of information there. And you know, brain mappers like to work with scalars. But this is work by Natasha Lepore in our group. If you've turned these deformation maps into basically a strain matrix, so the derivatives of a vector field are a tensor field, basically the Jacobian matrix. Things could be happening in the brain that are anisotropic, or they could even be opposing each other and contracting in one direction and expanding in the other. So this conventional approach, tensor-based morphology, basically looking at the compression in these mappings, would be bad. So let's regard these as elements of the positive definite real symmetric matrix group in 3D, and basically frames. Those little grids in 3D would be like little frames. Let's take, basically SIM3 is a Riemannian manifold. It's not got a flat Gordon system you can put on it. But you can use the exponential mapping to flatten it out. And then everything is signals in R6. You can look at covariances. Keith has a very nice theory of Hotelling's T-squared random fields. So if you have fields of symmetric matrices, you can biject them into a flat manifold. Then the signals in R6 can be assessed using pattern recognition, look at the covariance, and look at the Hal-Lewis distance. So you can make F distributions out of your tensors. I mean, there's kind of a lot of conventional techniques put together in a nice way. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, someone's going to say, well, I'm a neuroscientist, do I have to learn about this? Well, if you are analyzing these things in the normal way, you find nothing at all. I mean, it's just, this is sort of a nice example because this is brain deficits in HIV. If you analyze the compression at each point, you would find, this is those of you familiar with false discovery rate, it's a cumulative histogram of the p-values, the significance values, for different points in the brain where you're looking at a statistic that identifies group difference. If there isn't any difference, the histogram of p-values that you get in the brain versus a null distribution, so these are sort of QQ plots, for no effect, you're going to follow a diagonal line. There's going to be exactly a tenth of the brain with p-values less than 0.1. So the Jacobian, I'm lying. The determinant is the Jacobian, and it's not bad. But it's outperformed substantially by the multivariate measures. So one of the things we're trying to show is that if you use information theory for the matching, if you use multivariate statistics for the strain analyses, you may get a little bit more ground. Now the French group at INRIA had said to us, and these are people, Nicolas Ayash, Xavier Pennet, who many of you know, why are you using fluid regularizers when you are going to later on look at the log of the strain tensor? I mean, why are you going to regularize using one functional and then look at the result of another functional? So I think maybe this morphometric approach sort of it assumes that you're going to get statistics on these tensors that are following a multivariate normal distribution under the null hypothesis. This is actually impossible if the flows are governed by Euclidean fluid or elastic models, under some assumptions like volume preservation. And you could examine other cases. There's posters here by Igor Yanovsky. Igor is here. So this is his work with Alex Liao. And he's been looking at the case where if you use a fluid prior, and then you take the basically the Jacobian matrix at each point and you log it, you'll basically outperform the standard fluid priors if you think of a different prior that's based on the log of the Jacobian matrix, but this is treated as a symmetric tensor. And I'll give you an example of one regularizer that's very nice. It's one called Riemannian elasticity, or it's a little bit more intuitive to say log Euclidean Riemannian elasticity. You take the deformation of the mapping, you treat this as a positive definite symmetric matrix, you have to multiply the gradient of the mapping by its transpose to get symmetry. And then you say, well, look, if I log this matrix, I'll get a mean zero process in R6, or it's isomorphic to a mean zero process in R6. So let's just use a metric in R6, and it's the flattening threshold. We'll integrate how much this tensor is deviating from zero. We'll use some kind of L2 norm here, and I don't know why that quarter is in there. You guys know that's there. But we can ask the question, does this buy you power? I mean, you can study disease and see if it's any better. So one of the sort of interesting areas that's very underexplored is that these do generate diffeomorphisms. And so if you have a log prior, it isn't diffeomorphic, but you can change it a little. This is work by Caroline Brown, who's a graduate student working with me and with Natasha Lepre. She's trying to modify these log tensor priors on flows to make them diffeomorphisms. I mean, obviously, a control problem can be formulated in which the integral of a non-diffeomorphic flow is diffeomorphic. And so these are very, very different than the models that we're used to thinking of. But I mean, there's sort of the brain mapping community analyzing logs of Jacobians. And in a sense, we might want some distributions that have Gibbs priors with the same analytic form. So this is kind of an interesting area of work. This is too difficult to explain. This work by Alex Liao. She is an MD, PhD, who I think is uniquely brilliant. I mean, she's a medical resident who's a mathematician. Stan knows her very well. And she's interested in these Chernoff priors. They're models which treat the material compression. So let's say you have the unit cube and you flow it around. I mean, and let's say the volume integrates to one, so when you flow it, you can look at the Jacobian of the mapping. Treat the Jacobian of the mapping as a PDF, and it integrates to one. Think of this as a probability density function. It's the material density function. You can define these Chernoff priors, or basically measures of discrepancy between material density in the current state of deformation versus the unstrained deformation. And all of these things, I mean, it's not really remarkable. They become things like Kullback-Leibler in very simple forms between PDFs. If you think of these material densities as density functions, and you use all the information theoretic power of these metrics, this isn't a metric, but you can symmetrize it, you can think of new measures of deformation, basically the information contained in flow. This is an interesting idea. One reason I'm saying this is that there's proofs in papers by Alex Liao that these are symmetric and inverse consistent. They're actually not diffeomorphic. One of the reasons that they're not is that they're basically regularizing logs, and logs are very, very free transforms. But this is sort of a nice application of information theory, not to the signal, the data term, but to the flow which is being used. Now, there's not really much time, so in the last 2 minutes, I'll talk about this. Now, this is something we can't do, but I think, with all the joint expertise of folks in the crew, it's really an interesting problem for us to think about. All of our work has been on leads. And, we did a kind of extreme job of making tensors out of them. But there's another way you can make tensors out of brains. And you just scan the brain, as I said before, with diffusion-sensitive gradients. Now, MRI is a decay process. You activate, you guys know this better than me, you raise protons into a magnetic resonance state, and the decay of those excitations is described by a temporal parameter and a decay constant. And the decay constant is usually just plotted. This is MRI. If you don't do that, but you look at the decay constant in n different directions sampled uniformly on the sphere, well, you may not be able to sample uniformly on the sphere, you can get a radial orientation function. So basically a function which is a single-valued function of angle. And I mean, because it's so horrible, you might want to fit a tensor, so a second-order model to this. And one of the things that's very interesting about this is that information theory is very nice again. So this again is work by Ming Chang. It's a very, very nice idea. People want to deform these DTI datasets into register. Well, what flow do you use? What mathematical force drives these datasets into alignment? Well, there's a lot of metrics on tensors. I mean, we talked about half a dozen. So you can fit diffusion. If it's anisotropic diffusion, you can say, well, to first order, actually to second order is a tensor. You can get D. D is a nice metric. I mean, you basically use that as a metric for, you know, distance between points. In the worst case, I mean, you know, neuroscientists never stop. I mean, they want to collect more data, and this is sort of an angular diffusion function. You can ask the question, how do I take P of R on the sphere onto Q of R on the sphere? This is just one pixel of information. So it's a diffusion function of one pixel. And, you know, this is a very active question, but it's, as you've seen before, it's been solved. You know, you can basically match radial functions with, well, you can do it parametrically with flows on the sphere in, you know, spherical harmonics, or you can do it using information theory. You can match PDFs. And I don't read all that, it's a bit much, but one of the ways that we've done this is rather interesting. It follows work by Christoph Lenglet, who's working with Guillermo Sapiro at Siemens. Is to take work that Tony Chan, Luminita Vasey, and others here have done on total variation. They did this before us. I don't know why I even said we did it, but we did it too. And basically denoise tensors using the Riemannian manifold structure to, you know, ensure that you don't get illegal data. And then I just want to show you what the data looks like. I mean, this is raw diffusion data that has had a tensor fitted. And it's a little bit noisy. I mean, you know, the level sets of things like anisotropy, which is the ratio of the largest and smallest eigenvalues, the level sets will be choppy. They won't match. But after some denoising, you can get some sort of chunks of coherent diffusion. The color here, I think, is the volume of the tensor. Is that right? I can't remember. But after tensor denoising, this is an idea that Ming Chang had. I basically, rather than parameterize everything, I mean, one of the lessons from level sets is that you can avoid parametric headaches by using implicit functions. I mean, maybe a nice idea is just to say, well, the diffusion is this kind of, you know, scalar process in 3D, 4D, if you think about time. And let's just compare these diffusion functions, you know, never mind whether it's a second order tensor or a very complicated star. And let's align brains such that you use a flow to align the diffusion process at each point with a diffusion process in another subject. And use this, I mean, the difference between two PDFs and nice metric is a symmetrized Kullback-Leibler divergence between the distributions. And this is nice, and it works. This is a paper that I think it got into it exactly, not too terrible. But look at how much of the technology is borrowed. I want to sort of emphasize how collaborative this field is. I mean, you know, work by, you know, Michael's group and others looking at these, you know, fluid diffeomorphic metric mappings. Michael and his group have looked at other measures for DTI aligning principal eigenvectors. You could look at inner products of principal eigenvectors. You know, other functionals may be better. But, you know, it's also a challenge. I mean, these Hardy models, I mean, I told you about aligning tensors. There's nice analytic forms for the gradient descent in the case where the things are tensors. This was derived by others, and Ming Chang used this in his work. Think about the case where you have your entire spherical harmonic expansions per point. And it's actually even more horrible than this. I mean, if you flow tensors with a fluid, you know, through Helmholtz polarization of fluid, you know, there's sort of a rotational component and a non-rotational component in a flow. And I mean, it's actually a horrible problem. I mean, if you have this nice track that has diffusion aligned and it has these nice integral curves, as soon as you apply a flow, a non-rigid flow anyway, you've spun, and all the geodesics are messed up. And all the eigenvectors don't really, you know, connect together. So there's a lot of work. I mean, you know, one area, you know, Jim G is a pioneer in this area, and many others that we know, is trying to, during these fluid flows of tensors, remove the rotational component of the flow and only apply the translation. And it's kind of a, you know, very difficult problem. It's like using a screwdriver to rotate little beams in 3D while they're moving. And it's sort of an interesting problem. So anyway, last slide. I don't want to overrun. So this is the last slide. It's actually beautiful. It kind of works. So this is a person. This is a different person's DTI. And another challenge is visualization. How do you know if ODFs are aligned when you have fields of 8 million orientation diffusion functions? There's a challenge for visualization. But Ming Chang has a paper submitted on this, and many others in Michael's group and elsewhere are working on this problem. They're really metrics on manifolds. I'm going to show you the correlation. So Guillermo Shapiro was right. Most of brain mapping is matching of Riemannian manifolds. And if you're denoising, the manifolds have a certain form. If you're doing signal registration, these two manifolds. And if you're filling paths and diffusion data, you have harmonic mappings and things like that cropping up again. So the mathematical challenges that I think are out there for us for the future, this is like bringing coals to Newcastle. It's a British expression. It's best to not talk about level sets at ICANN, but I think this is a very interesting area for brain mappers.
Can you imagine the new term, diffeomorphic flows of level sets?
That sounds good.
That
should be the mantra for the next meeting. And then to neuroscientists, I would think neuroimagers are fairly mathematically literate, but I think there's a whole new vocabulary of mappings that I think needs to be introduced to many of the people using this data. And I think we saw in Xingtong Yao's talk, it's very interesting, someone coming from the domain of exterior calculus, Ricci flow, a lot of work with surface metrics. There are techniques that you wouldn't even think about if you're used to making vector fields from continuum mechanics. And the sort of efficiency and economy of representation that's available to differential geometers, but it's not necessarily a natural inference for neuroscientists. And then one of my favorite areas is genetics and the brain. I don't know why that's interesting. I guess it's kind of difficult. But just this whole idea of using genetic models, there's a lot of rich mathematics from genetics, which I don't know anything about, but plotting these on manifolds that have been aligned and denoised and registered seems like a useful thing. So I'll conclude by thanking Peter and Mark and all the organizers and all the speakers and all of you for coming and making this such a terrific piece.